Questioning Paul, Chapter 2, Part 6.
Christian theologians are deliberately being inconsistent, because gospel and good news are central to their theology. Christendom is based upon these concepts. It is as critical and errant as the doctrine of the Trinity in this regard. We find the following in Jerome's blend of the old Latin manuscripts.
But if anyone, even we ourselves or an angelist from heaven, were to evangelize other than the one that we evangelize amongst you, let him be anathema.
Once again, we find evidence that Jerome wasn't to blame for the corruption of evangelizo, but he was to blame for the subsequent treatment of Catholic heretics, due to his personalizing of the curse. These translations all affirm that Paul wanted his rivals cursed, and by his definition, his opponents were those whose message was contrary to his own. So as we will discover as we make our way through this letter, Shaul's rivals will come to include Yahweh and his prophets and Yahusha and his disciples. While they all spoke with one voice, their message was contrary to Shaul's, and that is the bottom line. Repeating himself, but this time slipping from first person plural to singular to underscore the fact that this Benjamite was a lone wolf among men, we are left to question the motivation for the duplication. And with Shaul so overly fixated on his rivals, do you suppose the reason he didn't name them was because, had he done so, his credibility would have been destroyed? The Nestle Allen MCREYNOLDS interlinear reads,
as we have said before and now again I say, if some you tells good message from what you took along curse let be.
The basis of their translation was as follows.
As we have said before, and even just now also I say, if someone delivers a helpful messenger or communicates a useful message to you contrary or in opposition to that which you received, it shall be a curse with a dreadful consequence. Galatians 1 verse 9.
Since this is Paul's first letter, the "as we have said before" is little more than a reference to the previous sentence, something he makes clear by way of RT, simultaneously and immediately thereafter. As a result, since Paulus is writing exclusively under his own chosen name, we must consider what he was trying to accomplish by using "we," and then ponder why then he felt it was necessary to transition back to I, who were his partners and why at times did he exclude them. It is telling, therefore, that Galatians 1 verse 6 begins, I am amazed, first person singular present tense, but then transitions to we delivered, first person plural past tense, in Galatians 1 verse 8. Paul's recent visit to Galatia was with Barnabas, according to Acts, perhaps accounting for the prior and plural message delivery. But in the short period between the Jerusalem summit and the time this letter was dictated, Barnabas and Shaul had a heated argument and split up, accounting for the present singular perspective. At least that would be the case had Galatians 1 verse 9 not included we and I in immediate succession. Also interesting, Shaul will take a mean-spirited swipe at Barnabas before this letter is through. As is the case with everything Paul writes, he never bothers to explain the nature of the argument. All this says is that I'm always right and everyone else is always wrong. As such, even if Shaul's opinions were right, without a basis in fact, this wouldn't be helpful. Thus far, and indeed throughout Paul's letters, we will be exposed to Paul's opinions, and we will be apprised of his attitude, but nothing else. Other than omitting the accusative contrary or in opposition to, adding preach, without justification, replacing the verb evangelizo with the noun gospel, and adding a pronoun at the end of the verse, the KJV got most of this right.
As we said before, so say I now again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than that ye have received, let him be accursed.
Their inspiration was obviously Jerome's Latin Vulgate.
Just as we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone has evangelize verit to you, other than that which you have received, let him be anathema.
The .New Living Translation paraphrase reads,
I say again what we have said before. If anyone preaches any other good news than the one you welcomed, let that person be cursed.
All three versions were unable to translate para, meaning close, but yet in opposition, appropriately when it was used in conjunction with their gospel and good news. But by changing paralambano to welcomed, the .New Living Translation was, once again, the least accurate. Before we move on, I want to underscore a deficiency associated with the previous statements and indeed with all of Schwal's letters. For this to be an effective warning, for it to be instructive and useful, we must know exactly what Paul told the Galatians, and also know how his preaching differed from those he was cursing. Without this information, speculation reigns supreme, and false interpretations are far too readily developed. As it stands, all we have is that anyone who delivers a message which differs from Paul's should be cursed, all of which sounds hauntingly similar to the Quran's first 80 surahs chronologically. And while that was designed to censure debate, and while it has kept most critics at bay, by repeating this, Paul has tipped his hand. He has said that his skin and doctrine are so thin that neither can tolerate criticism. It is a sure sign of insecurity. Those who cannot defend their message attack those who are critical of it. In politics, this strategy is known as killing the messenger. Introductions aside, here is a quick review of Schwal's second and third sentences.
I marvel, am amazed and astonished, wondering and surprised that namely in this way quickly and in haste you change, desert, and depart, becoming disloyal apostates and traitors away from your calling in the name of grace to a different healing message and beneficial messenger, 1 verse 6, which does not exist differently, if not conditionally or hypothetically negated because perhaps some are the ones stirring you up, confusing you, and also wanting and proposing to change and pervert the beneficial messenger and healing message of the Christ 1 verse 7, but to the contrary, if we or a messenger out of heaven conveys a healing messenger or beneficial message to you which is approximate or contrary to, beyond, or positioned alongside what we delivered as a beneficial messenger and announced as a healing message to you, then a curse with a dreadful consequence exists. 1 verse 8, as we have said already, and even just now, immediately thereafter, repetitively, I say, if under the conditions someone delivers a helpful messenger or communicates a useful message to you contrary or in opposition to, close or approximate to, even greater than that which you received, it shall be, in fact I command and want it to exist as, a curse with a dreadful consequence. Galatians 1 verse 9.
As we move to the next statement, while the interrogative required to frame the questions presented in most English translations do not appear in the Greek text, they are implied because Paul is asking us to choose. These questions, however, are rather odd considering the fact that Paul has pitted his message against God also. The first is advanced using a peculiar verb, one that runs the gambit from perplexing to inappropriate, from conceited to bewildering. If I may, since the writing quality is so poor, let's begin with the Nestle-Aland MCREYNOLDS interlinear.
Now for men I persuade or the God or I seek men to please. If still men, I was pleasing of Christ, slave not, I was.
So then amplified, we find.
For currently men I persuade or the God, or I seek to please men, yet nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating slave of Christ too, certainly not was me. Galatians 1 verse 10.
The initial verb, pato, was written in the first person singular, present active indicative, which not only means that Paulus is again operating on his own, but also that the opening sentence literally reads, because currently men I presently, actively, and actually use words to win the favor of, pato, or the God. So regardless of which option we choose, this question poses a series of serious problems. First, the transition from we, as the sources of the lone acceptable message and as the originators of the curse, to I, in a question, where man, and God, represent the universe of potential answers, is curious. rather than partnering with men, as we might imply, is Paul opposing men in some sort of grand debate? Or rather than partnering with God, as we might also suggest, is Paul actually arguing against him? And while Paul's personal confessions, his positions and his approach, affirm that his partner is Satan, there is a hint of delusional arrogance here in this transition back to I, because, no matter how we translate Pto, Paul is implying that his rhetoric and reason are sublime. It is as if he wants us to believe that he was so much smarter than everyone else, he could take on God and men single-handed. Second, winning favor, along with persuade and convince, is the best we can do with Pto. Every other connotation makes this question substantially worse, because it would read, I presently, actively, and actually seduce, mislead, coax, appease, and placate, men or God. Third, in spite of what religious zealots have been led to believe, we are not called to win the favor of men, and we cannot win the favor of God. We are not called to persuade or convince men. And the notion of persuading and convincing God is nonsensical. It's God's job to convince, not ours. And even then, Yahweh isn't interested in winning our favor, or in persuading us. He lays out the opportunity to form a relationship with Him. He proves that we can trust Him, and He invites us to get to know Him, but that is as far as God goes. Therefore, even if we render Pto as favorably as possible, if the answer to the question is men, Paul's approach is ungodly, and if the answer is God, then Paul's arrogance is in league with Satan. That's the good news. When any of Pto's alternative definitions are considered, Paul becomes the lord of deceit. The devil Pto seduces, misleads, coaxes, appeases, and placates. That is why he is known as the prince of lies. As you might suspect, Pto is almost exclusively Pauline. It is used in Paul's letters and attributed to him throughout Acts. One of the few times it is found in association with Yahusha, Magdania is translated using it to convey the religious mindset of the opposition by writing, but the chief priests and elders told the multitude that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Yahusha. Shortly thereafter, in 28 verse 14, and now in a political setting, Magdania is translated using Pto again to say, and if this comes to the governor's ears, we will Pto him. Luke, who was Paul's attaché for a while, in his hearsay account, translates Yahusha, using Pto twice, but neither translation is credible in that Luke wasn't an eyewitness and Yahusha never spoke Greek. Now I understand that religious individuals don't see any issue with men persuading other men on behalf of God, but that is because they have been deceived into believing that it is God's will that we win souls for Him. They see a conversion to their religion as a favorable event, as something that bolsters their faith. They not only send out evangelists to persuade people into believing as they do, the church has used the threat of violence to convert the masses for centuries. But not only is Paul's message opposed to God's message, winning souls isn't God's style. He is only interested in people who are interested in Him, and all He wants any of us to understand is who He is and what He is offering. That way we can choose of our own volition to get to know Him, to ignore Him, or to reject Him with God. It is all about free will. These things known, there is no way to overemphasize the consequence of this question. No matter the answer, it proves that Paul did not speak for God. It also demonstrates that his use of we did not include God. But it does not get better from here. After posing a question where both options have horrendous ramifications, indeed religious implications, Shaul spins his question, posing it a different way. And yet, we ought not try to accommodate or please men. Yahweh doesn't. Yahusha didn't. In fact, God's approach is the opposite. He is resolutely intolerant. He does not accommodate the views of the vast preponderance of people. And He is displeased with humanity. While it is Yahweh's desire for us to get to know Him, He only accommodates the few who do. Also problematic, with the juxtaposition of the first and second E, or, we cannot isolate Paul seeking to please men, from the possibility that he is attempting to accommodate God. The first option is disingenuous and pathetic, while the second is ludicrous. Not only were these questions left unanswered, which leaves one wondering why they were posed, they were followed by Edu, nevertheless, and I, if, strongly suggesting that Paul actually wanted us to think that he was capable of sparring with God further, Ersko, the next verb Paul deploys, isn't a cerebral concept, but instead speaks of exciting and enticing emotions. And the object this time is Christu, indicating that God, rather than being predictable and dependable, can be swayed by an emotional appeal. So while Yahusha has an emotional component to his nature, everything that we know about God affirms that he values an informed and rational response over misdirected feelings. It should go without saying, but because Paul routinely infers that he died to become Christ, which is what of Christu, certainly not was me, conveys, to the degree that this is thought to be the Messiah Yahusha, nothing could be further from the truth. However, if one sees Paul's Jesu Christu as the new and mythological caricature upon which the Pauline religion was contrived, then the author of this letter is the living embodiment of the Christian Jesus Christ. Paul is to Jesus Christ, as Muhammad is to Allah. They are one and the same. If you know one, you know the other. If you like one, you'll like the other. If we were to dispense with the dubious connections, and evaluate Paul's rhetoric as if this was a debate, he'd flunk that test too. Shaw will deploy a non sequitur. The initial question was not answered by his hypothetical. And there was no quid pro quo between accommodating man and serving his chistu. Moreover, how is it that Paul, who fashions himself as the one who liberated the faithful from bondage to the Torah, is now positioning himself as a slave? And not just anybody's slave, he is now in servitude to the same Christu whose death supposedly freed everyone from slavery. So this has become a litany of contradictions. And the fact remains, only an egomaniac would suggest that someone might actually wonder whether or not this man was persuading God, and that is especially troublesome since the opening stanza of this letter affirms that Paul wasn't effectively persuading and convincing men. Beyond this, perhaps we can deduce that Paul's intent was to convince his audience, by displaying hostility toward the Galatians at large, as well as against any other messenger or message, that he was demonstrating, even proving, that he was up to please God and not men. But nothing displeases God more than denouncing and discarding his testimony. This is a serious problem for thinking Christians. When Paul wasn't focusing on himself, he was focused on presenting an errant characterization of Yahusha. Neither perspective has merit. Even Yahusha told us that we should focus on the Father and not on him, but since Paul is opposed to Yahweh and his Torah, that isn't possible. I am keenly aware that there is a limit to the amount of criticism an audience will endure. And while we are called to love our enemies, we are actually encouraged to expose and condemn God's foes, which is why questioning Paul is so essential. But to be appropriate, our criticisms need to be bolstered by evidence and reason. They need to be consistent with God's testimony, and they should be focused on an individual, an institution, or on a specific message. However, in Paul's case, his blanket dismissal of an entire province and nation isn't appropriate, nor is criticism without justification, and Paul seldom if ever provides any. This letter opens similarly to the Roman 7 diatribe, with a universal condemnation. So while it is appropriate to constructively criticize religious documents and institutions, it is not appropriate to rail against their victims en masse. And yet, Paul is lashing out at everyone, while undermining everyone, because he suspects everyone is his foe, from heaven to earth, and he feels compelled to cut them all down. In this regard, his tone will evolve from condescending to vicious, becoming stunningly uncivilized. And while never appropriate, since Paul posed the question, his wholly antagonistic attitude toward men reveals the answer to the questions he has posed. In his mind, he was debating God. Moreover, as the evidence will demonstrate, Paul's rage was universally misplaced. Shaul's adversaries were leading the Galatians to Yahweh, while Shaul was taking them for a ride in the opposite direction. Apart from the errant title, Christ, my concern with the most influential translations is that neither were consistent with the actual text. They both added a plethora of words to artificially elevate the writing quality. While Paul wrote,
"For because currently and simultaneously, men I persuade, I presently, actively, and actually use words to win the favor of, seducing, misleading, coaxing, convincing, appeasing, and placating, or alternatively, the God, or by comparison and contrast, I seek and desire to please and accommodate humans. Yet nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating, exciting the emotions of and lifting up a slave of Christ too, certainly not was me."
The KJV published.
"For do I now persuade men, or God, or do I seek to please men? For if I yet pleased men, I should not be the servant of Christ."
While Christians no doubt see this as a rhetorical question, the deeper we dig into Paul's mantra and mindset, the more likely it becomes that Paul thought himself qualified to persuade God to change his plan of salvation. LV.
"For am I now persuading men, or God? Or, am I seeking to please men? If I still were pleasing men, then I would not be a servant of Christ."
Unlike the King James and Vulgate, the New Living Translation reads beautifully. It is a shame God didn't inspire Paul to write as eloquently.
"Obviously, I'm not trying to win the approval of people, but of God. If pleasing people were my goal, I would not be Christ's servant."
While there is an extremely remote possibility that this may have been what he meant to say, it absolutely wasn't what he wrote. And should they have magically captured Paul's intent, we are incapable of winning the approval of God. That is the reason God conceived a plan whereby he did all that was required to make us acceptable. Next, we find Shaul professing that the message he was revealing was his own. And Paulus wanted everyone the world over to recognize that the mantra which would become known as the gospel, was hypo-ego, by, under and through me, by reason and force of me, because of uncontrolled by me.
"But I profess and reveal to you brothers of the beneficial messenger and healing message which having been communicated advantageously by myself, because it is not in accord with man." Galatians 1 verse 11.
This, of course, means that Paul was solely responsible for his gospel. He conceived it all by himself, and he, alone, was authorized to declare it. As such, Paul was solely responsible for the mythology which became Christianity. There is no one else to credit or to blame. If his personal and individual revelations are not true, the religion he conceived is wholly unreliable. Christian clerics universally recognize and readily admit that Paul opposed Yahusha's disciples. This statement merely explains why. His message was his own while theirs was Yahusha's. And set into the context of debating God, this is an incriminating confession. But even if you were unaware of Paul's underhanded slap at his adversaries, both human and divine, it was either egregiously presumptuous or an outrageous confession to write Norizo, "I reveal and provide, the Wangelion, beneficial messenger and healing message, and I Wangelizo, communicate it advantageously, hypo-ego, by myself." If Paul were speaking for God, shouldn't he be touting his words and not his own? Said another way, someone who is actually speaking for God knows that it's his message which matters, not the one who delivers it. Had this been anything more than Paul claiming the world is his own, he would have done what we are doing, which is to dissect the errant message, showing through evidence and reason where it is wrong. Shaul should have delineated pertinent examples of the Wangelion which differed from his own. But the only message Paulus has condemned is God's, discrediting and discarding his Torah. The MCREYNOLDS interlinear reveals that the Nassau-Allen text reads,
"I make known for to you brothers the good message, the having been told good message by me, that not it is by man."
So in order to make those words appear credible, Wangelion and Wangelizo had to be rendered differently, even though their etymological basis is identical in the KJV.
"But I certify you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached of me is not after man."
That was incriminating. The King James Version accurately asserted that Paul certified that the gospel which was preached was of me. In a rational world, this would have been sufficient to bury him. Jerome's blend of old Latin texts was both less accurate and less convicting. LV.
For I would have you understand, brothers, that the evangelium which has been evangelizatum by me is not according to man.
But ever in form, the New Living Translation ignored 6 of the 12 Greek words, and they added 10 English words of their own choosing. Still inadequate to support their theology, they grossly misrepresented, and inconsistently translated euangelion.
Dear brothers and sisters, I want you to understand that the gospel message I preach is not based on mere human reasoning.
The use of mere implies that human reasoning was a contributing factor, and that suggests that Yahweh's message was incomplete or inadequate, and that he required the contribution of Shorwell's considerable intellect. When you combine Paul's arrogant and incriminating statements with the Christian interpretation of them, you have the crime and confession laid at your feet. So why have so few people held Paul accountable? What follows is the other half of Shorwell's defense. He's saying that he wasn't influenced by any human agenda or institution, while implying that those who oppose him are in opposition to God. The opposite, however, is true. Paul's approach and style are rabbinic, and it would be hard to find someone more opposed to God than he. Now if only someone could have taught Paulus how to write.
But neither because I by man associating myself with it, nor was I taught, but to the contrary by way of a revelation of Iesu Christu. Galatians 1 verse 12.
Contradicting his previous statement, while at the same time contradicting Yahweh's and Yahusha's approach to teaching, Paulus would have us believe that he did not associate with men and that he was not taught. He is evidently not ready to disclose the fact that he has been in rabbinic school for many years. According to Paulus, his message had been previously undisclosed, and he alone had the right to convey what was miraculously unveiled, appearing to him in a revelation attested by no one. So it begs the question, if this is so, why did Yahweh bother with his Torah teaching? If this is so, why did Yahusha bother with disciples? If this is so, why did Yahusha bother to say or do anything? If this is so, why did Yahusha direct those with questions to the Torah and prophets for answers? If this is so, how could Paulus be speaking for Yahusha when God's attitude, approach, and affirmations were the antithesis of what is being written here? Since it would be natural to assume that I'm sabotaging Paul by making him appear illiterate, please note that the Scholastic Nessalalent published.
But not for I from man took along it, nor was I taught, but through uncovering of Jesus Christ.
Beyond the fact that I now understand that the underlying purpose of Galatians was to separate Yahusha from the Torah, and thereby negate his sacrifice while nullifying the means to our salvation, to say that he was not taught, his message is to say that he did not learn the truth in the same place Yahweh and Yahusha directed all of us to go for understanding. The Torah. Neither Shaul, you, nor I need private instruction regarding God's public disclosure. Proving this, the disciple Yahushanan recorded.
Yahusha answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all of the Yehudim come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. John 18 verse 20.
This, of course, would also mean that what Paul just wrote was a lie. Yahusha's statement and Paul's cannot be reconciled. This was not Paul's only claim to secret revelation. In the New American Standard Bible's rendition of Romans 16 verse 25, we read,
Now to him who is able to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery which has been kept secret for a long ages past but is now manifested.
According to my gospel, confirms the obvious, but nonetheless I appreciate the confession. This is the gospel of Paul, and not the gospel of Jesus Christ. But God doesn't keep secrets, at least not regarding anything vital to our relationship with him. Mysteries formed the sum and substance of the myths which permeate pagan religions. And since Paul never once cited Yahusha's preaching, in a rare moment of truth, calling the gospel, he was preaching his own, should have been sufficient for Christians to reject him and their religion. God does not have a gospel, nor should you. And speaking of revealing something important regarding Yahusha, this is now the third time in three tries that Paulus has not only placed his title after his name, but has omitted the requisite definite article. The backwards approach gives the impression that Jesus' last name was Christou, further distancing him from Yahweh. Paul's fixation on unverifiable secret revelations, on mystery and mythology, was further advanced in his letter to the Ephesians, when according to the New American Standard Bible, he wrote,
"If indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace which was given to me for you, that by revelation there was made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief, and by referring to this, when you read you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles and prophets in the Spirit, of which I was made a minister, to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ and to bring to light what is the administration of the mystery which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things." Ephesians 3 verse 2-9.
Funny thing though, the prophets never spoke of mysteries, and to the contrary, Yahweh used them to dispel myths. The disciples never spoke of mysteries either, nor did Yahusha. For those who are open to him, Yahweh is an open book. Open his Torah and you will find him there. In fact, the only reason that God authored his Torah was to reveal himself to us so that we might come to know him. King Dowd, more commonly known as David, was inspired to share the following insight into the nature, purpose, and effect of the Torah.
Yahweh's Torah is complete and entirely perfect, returning, restoring, and transforming the soul. Yahweh's eternal testimony is trustworthy and reliable, making understanding and obtaining wisdom simple for the open-minded. Psalm 19 verse 7.
Few things so essential to life are this succinct, and that is why you've seen this verse before and will see it again. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the murderer who had been Shaul, who by his account was forced to become an apostle during a rather nasty encounter with a prodding and debilitating spirit on the road to Damascus, was a special case, that he was too remarkable an individual to learn about God the way the rest of us mere mortals have done, by observing the Torah as God suggested. It's certainly God's prerogative to teach someone individually if he so desires. The disciples had some group instruction, most of which they made public. And their subsequent message, unlike Shaul's, was wholly consistent with everything Yahweh and Yahusha proclaimed publicly. So if God had a private meeting with Paul, why was there no prophetic affirmation of it, and why was everything they allegedly discussed the opposite of what had been conveyed so many times before? And why do you suppose, if this revelation actually occurred as Paul professes, that there isn't a single quote from Yahusha in the collection of Paul's letters? Rather than write, Yahusha said, Paul wrote, but I say, beyond not citing anything from their mythical private meeting, the self-proclaimed apostle only quoted one snippet of something Yahusha said publicly, and in his lone citation, Shaul bungled the quote. As such, Paul's entire premise is ludicrous. And most revealing and incriminating of all is the realization that Paul's message is the antithesis of everyone else's, including Yahweh, who just happens to be God, all of Yahweh's prophets, Yahusha, who just happens to be the living manifestation of the Word, and Yahusha's disciples. It was one man against the Word and world. Everything the Messiah did and said affirmed the importance of the Torah. And yet the primary thrust of Shaul's testimony is to belittle and demean the Torah. His claim to a secret revelation from God for which he alone has a license to promote is not only rationally impossible, it is preposterous. While I'm admitting flogging a dead pig, since so many seem oblivious to the obvious, if Shaul spent time one-on-one with Yahusha, as he claims, why didn't he tell us anything about his encounter? Why, unlike everything else God has revealed, wasn't there a single prophecy which could be used to validate the inspiration? The Torah, by contrast, is set into the context of history. It details Moses' meetings with Yahweh, in addition to their interactions with the Egyptians and the children of Israel over the course of time. There are not only thousands of witnesses, the Torah is filled with historical and prophetic insights which serve to verify its validity. Moreover, its primary purpose was to explain the purpose of God, and that means to Yahusha, was not only included, but was also explained and predicted in this very same plan. And now we are to believe that all of those promises and predictions were for naught. There was no reason for any of it. Also relevant, since most of the Torah consists of Yahweh speaking in first person through Moses, which is the same format used throughout the prophets, why is Galatians written in Paul's voice? The prophets Zechariah, Yeshayah, Jeremiah, and Malachi, to name a few, routinely get out of the way and allow Yahweh to speak through them. Their personalities, their styles, their messages, and their reputations are never an issue. But the same cannot be said of Paul. There are seven signs, all along the same path, all pointed in the same direction, all conveying the same message, all from the same God, and then there is Shaul. And his sign is on a distinctly different path, it points in the opposite direction, and it conveys an entirely different message. And yet for every one person choosing to follow the path laid out by the seven in concert with God, hundreds of thousands prefer Paul's instead. Other than misrepresenting the second most important name and title in the universe, the KJV and LV handled the rest of the words appropriately enough. The King James reads,
"For I neither received it of man, neither was I taught it, but by the revelation of Jesus Christ."
LV.
"And I did not receive it from man, nor did I learn it, except through the revelation of Jesu Christi." Unable to restrain themselves, the New Living Translation felt compelled to add their own personal embellishments to an otherwise simple statement.
"I received my message from no human source, and no one taught me. Instead, I received it by direct revelation from Jesus Christ."
End of part 6.